Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Don't Dress for Dinner, a farce written by Mark Camaletti, adapted by Robin Hawden, and directed by John Tillinger, is running at the American Airlines Theater on West 42nd Street in New York City through June 17th. The play is nominated for 2 Tony Awards. This plot summary is from the show's website. Bernard's plans for a romantic rendezvous with his mistress are complete with a gourmet caterer and an alibi courtesy of his friend Robert. But when Bernard's wife learns that Robert will be visiting for the weekend, she decides to stay in town for a surprise tryst of her own, setting the stage for a collision course of assumed identities and outrageous infidelities. The cook is Suzette, the lover is Suzanne, the friend is bewildered, the wife is suspicious, and the husband is losing his mind. The show stars Ben Daniels as the friend, Patricia Kalember as the wife, Jennifer Tilly as the mistress, Tony nominee Spencer Caden as the cook, and Adam James as Bernard. I spoke with British actor Adam James recently about the challenges of doing a farce and some of his work on television. Adam James, welcome to the Roundtable.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
When did you first know you wanted to be an actor, and how did you go about pursuing that goal?
Wow. When did I know that? In truth, actually, I think I knew it from a very, very young age. Maybe it's something about being an only child and desperate for attention. But I remember doing awfully precocious things. Like, Mum would have these dinner parties and I would, you know, sing and do little comedy skits, and they would all sort of humour me. I'm sure they were horrendous. So I think from an early age, I had a sense that I wanted to perform, and the reaction that that gave me pleased me. So yes, I'm sure my therapist would have lots to say about that. So it was from an early age. And then at school, I did sort of the standard, all the school plays and things like that. And it just sort of made sense to me. It was something that sort of came naturally and quite easily, and I enjoyed it, and it gave me a lot of pleasure. And it felt like a sort of natural progression. So by the time I'd finished sort of school and was going to university, I kind of already knew that's what I wanted to pursue, but sort of went to university anyway to slightly humour my family and my parents. But then quickly realised there that I was sort of done with academia, and I thought, no, I want to get on and do this. But I was always quite young because my birthday was in September, so I sort of went ahead. So I then applied while I was still at university to various drama schools in London, all of which said I was far too young and that I should disappear and go and travel and, you know, come back the following year. Apart from one, actually, Central School of Speech and Drama, I'll never forget it. They said, no, we'll accept you. And then I was quite snobby about it. I went, oh, because they're in the process of being revamped, and it was sort of a series of porter cabins while they were having their building redone. And I thought, well, I don't want to go to a building site and train as an actor. But I got the sentiment from everybody else. I felt, yeah, I was sort of a young 18-year-old. So I did. I duly went off traveling for a year and then applied just to 2 drama schools when I came back, which was the Bristol Old Vic and the Guildhall School of Speech and Drama in London, because those were the 2 that I had the most, that I kind of liked the most during the audition process from the previous year. And I was accepted at both places and decided to go to Guildhall in London because my schooling had all been in Bristol. I just finished there. So I thought, no, I wanted to be back in London where I was born and start my training there. So that was it. So I trained there for 3 years, an excellent drama school, despite the building it's in. It's a bit like a nuclear bunker. It's in this area of London called the Barbican, which is kind of, I guess it must have been bombed to hell during the war because it's all nasty sort of 60s architecture now. But the training was excellent. And those were kind of my university days, I suppose. University years, I was there from 19 to 23, I suppose. And then that was it. And then signed by an agent and off we went into this crazy business.
How did you come to Don't Dress for Dinner? How did you get cast in the show?
It came sort of through the standard channels from my agents. They said, there's this play, are you interested in doing it? I was doing a play in London at the time at the National Theatre, and at the National we play in rep, and I was just about to have 2 weeks off from the show, and I'd booked this trip to Vietnam, and I was desperate to get away. I hadn't been away for ages. So they said, well, can you quickly put some scenes on tape and send them over to Roundabout? So I did. Not really thinking much of it. I thought, well, it's just be a bit of fun, but, you know. Because it's quite odd, particularly with a play, you sort of want to meet the director and sit down and discuss it. So I thought, well, maybe this will be just the first step. Off I went to Vietnam and was travelling around and got this extraordinary call about a week or so later saying that that was just an offer straight away, which was really thrilling and flattering. But I was aware that I think that Jim Carnahan, who casts for Roundabout, had seen a previous play I'd done here in New York about a year or 2 years ago called The Pride that Joe Mantello directed down at the Lucille Hotel. And I was aware that that had garnered me a bit of attention. And so maybe the combination of the two made it so that this offer came through. And I was thrilled because it's unlike anything I've ever done before. I mean, I was a little scared because farce is such a specific discipline, I guess, as an actor to try to achieve. And I'd never done broad comedy. I'd done comic roles, but nothing that is full-on comedy. And so it appealed. And, you know, what's not to like in New York? So it was really a no-brainer once the offer came through. I thought, yeah, I'm going to jump at that.
When they bring you over from England to do a show, do they put you up?
Good question. In this instance, they have, but I have a green card. So they have treated me as though I'm an American from another city. So they have flown me over and put me up, which has been brilliant. And I cannot fault Roundabout at all. I think they have been exemplary in the way they look after their actors here. I really, really think they're brilliant and have looked after us impeccably. When I did the Pride previously, it was for MCC, and I guess they have different budgetary constraints and so on. So they did employ me as a local actor. So it did mean that I had to fly myself out and put myself up, which was a bit tricky. Yeah. I mean, you know, accommodation in New York, as we all know, is hard and expensive at the best of times. But this time has been a breeze, and it's been a joy, and all that pressure and, you know, taken off. I mean, you can just concentrate on the work, which is great.
And takes, I mean, like you said, with a farce, it takes a lot of concentration.
It does.
What is the process of learning all of that, running about in physical comedy?
I think, I don't know. One of my other co-stars in it, Ben Daniels, is also a British actor. And I just think there's something in the British psyche that we just have a sense of what farce is. Either we've been brought up on it by going to see other farces at the theatre, or it's sort of inherently in our comedy, in our TV, our comedy. We've had Fawlty Towers, we've had Benny Hill, it's somehow in us. So when I read the play, I sort of had an immediate understanding of what was required. How we got there is down to rehearsals, but it requires far more energy than I ever anticipated and much more concentration. Even though the play isn't really about anything and it's not terribly profound in any way, it was technically a harder thing to learn because you're all speaking nonsense, and nonsense on top of nonsense on top of nonsense, covering each other's lies and double lies. It became one of the hardest things I've ever had to learn. And although it emotionally doesn't cost me much, every night Ben and I come off stage dripping. I mean, if you want to lose weight, do a farce. It's just exhausting. But it does dictate that. It requires a particular type of energy that I think it can only exist on, which, when you get it right, is thrilling, I think, both to perform and hopefully for you to watch as well, you know, for an audience to sort of see all of that.
Do you have a favorite scene to do each night, or does that, I mean, it's the kind of thing that might vary depending on the night?
I think I have a favorite sort of movement of the play, which is in the second half when the mania of the play and the madness of the play is really allowed to have its sort of full breadth. So you can sort of get away with extraordinary physicality and size of performance. And I quite enjoy the madness of that. And by that time, you've sort of got your audience completely on side. So anything kind of goes. And that's kind of thrilling because it's like a madness. It's kind of crazy. So that's always quite a joy to do. And this company is brilliant, but particularly working with Ben and I feel like a very well-oiled double act. So I really enjoy working with him. It's like a really good sort of tennis match between each other, sort of a good 1-2. But no, I'd say the second half of the play is something I always look forward to because it feels like you're given free rein and permission to be as big and as crazy as you can because the play will hold it.
Yep, set the table in Act 1 and bring out the seltzer bottles in Act 2.
Exactly.
What have been some of your other favorite projects you've worked on in your career?
The other play that I mentioned that I did here in New York in 2010, The Pride, was a very happy project, actually. It was an extraordinary bit of writing by Alexi K. Campbell. And I'd seen the original production of it at the Royal Court. And then this opportunity came up, and I jumped at it, least of all because the other people in the play were terrific actors. Hugh Dancy was in it, Andrea Riseborough, and Ben Whishaw, who I think is just extraordinary. But on top of that, I was afforded the opportunity of playing three very different characters. And that, for any actor, I think, is always such a lovely challenge, but a joy to be able to play such opposing characters. Hard, because you have to sort of come on and you have no sort of lead in time, no warm up. You're sort of on and you've got to make those characters for the audience very clearly defined very quickly. So it sort of ticked a lot of boxes artistically and as a challenge as an actor. So that was really thrilling. And then I suppose the plays I've done most recently at the National have also been just brilliant, just great bits of new writing. I think all the work that I've done of late that I'm most proud of is all new writing. There's a great young new playwright called Mike Bartlett, who I've worked with twice now, and his last play that I did at the National called 13. And I just think he's a brilliantly unique new voice that we've got. And that kind of work excites me. Sort of new writing is where I feel I most proud of the work that I've done at the National and the Royal Court. Yeah, I think that's where my heart in terms of theatre really lies, is new writing. I think it's important and it's exciting. You know, it's always great to define and create a role at the beginning.
This is where I get anxious that you, when doing an internet search on people, that you find the wrong people. Right. You know, you're researching and trying to learn what are his credits, what has he done, but Doctor Who?
Yes.
Okay, perfect. I'm a rather large nerd and a big fan of that. So I wanted you to talk about doing Doctor Who, if you don't mind.
Well, Doctor Who's a funny one, actually. It's sort of been in my, I don't know, in my sort of about me for a long time. My one of my godfathers was Doctor Who back in the day. John Pertwee was a godfather of mine, so he was Doctor Who. And then the Doctor Who that I did recently, I did because my best friend was playing Doctor Who. David Tennant is a very close friend of mine. And I wanted to do an episode with him before he left the show, and another friend of mine happened to be directing it. So it was just sort of one of these happy accidents. Again, I was doing a play at the National and I had time off, and it all sort of fitted very nicely. I can't profess to being a huge fan of it myself. I remember watching it as a child and being terrified by the Daleks and hiding behind the sofa and all of that. I had that, had the desired effect. But the reinvention of it that the BBC did has been such an enormous success, and rightly so. I think it's a brilliantly put together show. And then to have my friend David playing the Doctor, it seems foolhardy not to be part of that. And David, by his own admission, much like you, has been a Whovian for a long, long time. So I think it was even a bigger treat for him to finally get to play, you know, the part you've wanted all your life. So, it was just sort of a very lovely little special moment in time to be able to be part of that history with him and of that show, yeah.
And you did extras.
I did. I did do extras with our infamous Ricky Gervais. That was a very happy experience because obviously, you know, at that time, Ricky was still really huge and The Office was just a great seminal bit of TV that we'd all just watched. And I remember this audition came through and I was like, so excited at the prospect of it. It was such a great part as well. It was sort of a British version of the Ari Gold character in Entourage. And you learn, I suppose, in acts not to get too excited about it, but I prepared as best I could for it. And then I remember there was this this awful set of circumstances where I prepared really, really hard for it. I knew the casting director very well. I went in, auditioned. Ricky wasn't there. It was just me on tape with the casting director. And I thought, oh, well, you know, do your best. And then I was immediately going away on holiday. And I thought, well, either way, this holiday is going to be ruined because at best, if I have to get recalled, I'm going to have to cancel the holiday and come back. Or I'm going to hear that during the holiday, I'm not going to get the part and be upset. God knows how it happened. But the best scenario presented itself. Whilst I was on holiday, I just got the call that I'd been offered the part without having to come and meet Ricky and Steve. And so that was thrilling. So it turned out to be the best holiday ever. And then it was just glorious. And I, unlike others, I was on it for about 4 or 5 days because I had quite a few scenes, whereas most people who come and do guest bits. David, ironically, was in that episode as well. They normally come in and do a day. So I got to know Ricky quite well, as well as you can. But it was a very interesting experience. And I remember the very, very first day of shooting that I was on was the first day of the whole shoot. And I was quite struck by how nervous Ricky was because I think there was an expectant pressure at being the Christmas special and he hadn't been acting for a bit. And we were on location and these aeroplanes kept flying over every 2 minutes, sort of screwing up the sound. And Ricky got really, really angry, which suddenly started making me really, really tense. And I was having to play this agent who was terribly confident and, oh, it just became, you know, not the dream job that I thought it might be. There was this sort of awful moment of time where I thought, oh, God, he hates me and we're going to get fired. And it was fine. But it was extraordinary to, because he likes to shoot very quickly. He gets very impatient. And, you know, these planes coming over every 2 minutes were sort of preventing that happening. But it turned out to be a really, really happy job. And Ashley Jensen's also another very good friend of mine who's on the show as well. So it was lovely when she'd finished filming Ugly Betty and came over and joined us. And yeah, that was great. But I wasn't quite prepared for the reaction that it would have or the impact it had. I still get people coming up to me today and go, oh my God, you're his agent, you were in extras. It sort of has a resonance beyond any expectation that I had. It was, it's great. And of course, Ricky here now is just huge.
Adam, it's been a pleasure to meet you and a delight to speak with you. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Not at all. Lovely to meet you too.
Adam James stars as Bernard in Don't Dress for Dinner, which is running at the American Airlines Theater on West 42nd Street in New York City through June 17th. The play is produced by the Roundabout Theater Company. Visit roundabouttheater.org for more information. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.